You're listening to Cat
Tales. Hi, and welcome to another edition of Cat Tales. Two-time world superbike champion and former MotoGP rider James Toseland admits that it's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll, but is enjoying every moment of his second career as a successful musician and songwriter. Collaborating with Little Angels legend Toby Jepson, he has written two albums packed with classic rock and power ballads, toured with Deep Purple and Status Quo, and had Toseland's We'll Stop at Nothing adopted as the Special Olympics anthem in 2017. Now he gives us the inside scoop on the music industry and tells how going on stage is just as much of an adrenaline rush as motorcycle racing. This is The One with James Toseland.
How's things all right?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you doing?
Not too bad in these strange times. At least we're getting back to normality of some sort.
I know, and this is it. We all just want to get back to normality, I think, don't we? We've all had enough of it, really. I mean, how have you been coping with all this lockdown business then?
Not too bad, really. Luckily, we didn't have any touring or any anything of that nature kind of booked in. So there was no album release or anything like that, because if you just spent days and weeks and months writing new material and spending all the costs on recording something, and we've just got all the release of everything all planned with the, you know, as you know, it's got a real strategic kind of like plan to writing, recording, promoting and touring music, and it's literally within that order, and it can't really do it any other way when it comes to performing live, which for most artists is where they earn most of their income.
Yes.
And just looking at the news just 2 minutes ago, they're saying that theatres and everything else won't be open until 2021. So it's a big bitter blow, because you know that basically says that there won't be any live work in the UK until next year now, which when you're only in mid-June, it's another lengthy period, you know. And it's not just there's so many people involved in the music industry, you know. It's not just the artists that we're all familiar with. It's the crew, it's the people behind the scenes, it's the bus drivers and the tour companies and the caterers and everything else. If you're doing well enough to have caterers, there's so many companies, isn't there, that's involved in the live work thing. So it's really, really, really tough. And you know, if you're lucky enough to be the crew or any of that kind of world, that's well known enough to pick up the phone to maybe doing something in Europe or something in America or Australia, that doesn't have these kind of restrictions, and you can get some work, then that's good. But for a lot of the kind of grassroots bands like ourselves, and people just coming through, those people have just been told basically today that there's no more work for the rest of the year. Then that's a glum thought, isn't it?
It is. It's a bitter pill to swallow, really, isn't it? And you're saying there about there has to be a certain order for the process, doesn't there? And if now we're talking about next year to actually go and, you know, live gigging, then it's going to miss its cycle, isn't it? Because a lot of bands, a lot of people, a lot of musicians are actually doing their creative work now because there's not a lot else to do. But then once you've done that bit, you need to go out and sing it and take it somewhere, don't you, to actually get the revenue back in.
Yep. And, you know, if, the cost of recording music has come down dramatically as time's gone on, that's for sure. But it's still not cheap to record things properly. And depending on what kind of music you do, depends on the expense of it. I mean, I'm in a rock band myself, so you wouldn't want to record an album with false drums on it, with false musicianship on it, and just laying the vocal down. You want a live atmospheric playing live instrumentations on it, which to record each thing separately is costly. And you know, obviously dance music, when it's all electronically kind of recorded, is a much cheaper way of recording things. But obviously back in the days of tape and everything else, it was another level. But but then again you had more sales, you had more physical sales, which justified kind of spending that much money on the recordings, etc. So It's had a massive period of change, the music industry, on how people listen to music and how people buy music. And I think there's a bit of a rumor that the music industry was a little bit complacent when all of these streaming sites and everything else to get control of it at the early part of the early stages compared to the film industry that took much more control over how it was distributed and sold. And it had a bit of a knock-on effect on how revenue drips feeds back to the artists and the writers.
Yeah.
And because of that, it's taking some time to all straighten out on how things should be distributed to, making it viable to do as a business. Because it's a very expensive business to do live music because everything's up front when you go touring. You've got to book the hotels. You've got to book the van or the bus or however big you want to do it. You've got to book the catering. You've got to book the T-shirts and the merchandise. And you've got to pay for everything more or less before you even set off on the road for the first concert. Mm. I mean, just to give you an example, for a 2-week tour for us, we were probably between 200 and 500 people on average at most venues around the whole country, and it costed me about £15,000 just for the 2 weeks, and that is as cheap as you can do it. That was me driving the van, that was booking travel lodge hotels and stuff, spending it with two or three lads in the band. And yeah. It was service sandwiches and cheap as you could do it. And by the time you'd finished selling merchandise and tickets for those shows, we were just about breaking even. Yeah. But that was 7 or 8 years after starting out.
Yeah.
And to get a crowd of 200 to 500 people, it's some doing across the country. That's the minimum really that you need to break even with live performances.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? You see people from the outside of the industry look in, you know, the people who come to the performances don't, you know, see what goes on behind the scenes. Obviously, they have probably an appreciation of it to various different degrees. But when you put it into that context, you know, it's a massive investment, isn't it, before you actually earn one penny. And that's the problem, isn't it? And then you really got to get it to be a success. So when something like this COVID happens and it stops all that touring, a lot of bands have already invested money, haven't they?
Oh, yeah. And you've got no choice but to. You have to, obviously, your agent will be booking the shows all around the country with different venues and different promoters. And that takes, you know, the promoters want a good 3 months at least to say somebody's coming to that venue and in that area. So, you know, you've got to book a tour about 3 months in advance. So there's no going back then once you've kind of promoted the tour. But you have got to then put everybody else in the pipeline of doing the shows with the musicians and your crew and the sound engineer and guitar tech, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you've got to basically, for a 2-week tour, £15,000 is starting to be paid 3 months before you even do the show with just preparation. Yeah, but you know, it is altering though, because the days of people wanting a full album is kind of weaning away slowly, it seems. It just seems like people are just knocking out singles now just to keep themselves in the spotlight a little bit, to keep the name out there. And then they'll be able to do a tour off one or two singles that they drop. And then the album comes maybe 1 or 2 years after you've actually worked it.
Yeah.
Work the singles. So you're working the singles more than working the albums these days, which it can be more cost effective then, because you only have to go into the studio and record those two. I mean, you'll still have to write 20 or 30 songs to get two good ones.
That's another story.
Because that's just how it works. But if you do get two kind of songs that you think are going to be of interest, then those two songs can go through the radios and the publications to get the interest that the band's got this new single, and you can kind of just record that, tour that, and then bring the album out, and you could almost kind of have another hit at it once the album's out, because obviously there's a few more tracks on that, and you can almost do two or three tours now with one album with that system.
Yes.
And just touring the album once when it's all out there and all done, because you only get really 3 months of promotion with an album, And once it's out there, and once you've pushed as much as you can with the outlets that you've got, that's it, done. You've got about another one.
Yeah, this is it, isn't it? This is it. It's almost like going back, though, isn't it, in time to the old, you know, good old Top of the Pops days, when it was always about producing a single first and then the album on the back of it, wasn't it? And somewhere along the line, it changed when the CD came in, I think, and the music industry started to, you know, change from that format. And it sounds like it's going back there a little bit, which is nice. Yeah. That's good news.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's because it had to be cost effective then, when it was expensive to record. And no one really wanted to go down the line of recording 10 songs on tape. And so that's why they did it. And I think now, without knowing how many you're going to sell, it's gone back to that again, because it was the recording cost back in those days, wasn't it? But then they realised that they were selling millions of copies, because that's just how it was sold back then. But now they're not selling millions of hard copies, it's more streaming. So they've gone back to kind of having to do it more cost effective to be sustainable.
Technology. That's right. It's got a lot to answer for, really, hasn't it? You know, one respect it's really good, but in another respect, it really has made the industry difficult. And like you're saying there, with the streaming services, the music industry did seem a little bit late on catching on to the fact that they needed to do a good financial deal for the creators. And I think it's difficult now to backtrack on that, isn't it?
Well, more or less impossible, really. I mean, the only thing that they can hope for is that the governing body of the music industry, that they just pass legislation now to make things fairer. But without going hardball on it at the beginning, like the film industry did, it's a constant negotiation. Well, you know, a negotiation's a compromise, isn't it?
Exactly.
But I think the industry will have to see that it has to change its tact. Because you are definitely going to see artists and bands going by the wayside. Because what it's creating here that I found out since being in the industry is we've done two albums so far. We're looking at the third one, and this is 9 years now. And, you know, we're just about getting to the point where we're breaking even and we're on the main stages of festivals. Mm. But that's a 10-year process now. Before, when the industry had the level of income for songwriters and the way the industry worked, you know, you could have had that momentum 2 or 3 years in, and then getting the real support to go up to the next level. Because, like anything, you go up to the next level, everything gets more expensive. It's like if I had to tour the whole of Europe, which the label was wanting, but at my cost, which wasn't possible. Mm. The level that we were at in the UK back in the day, a label would definitely throwing a certain amount of money at it to be able to do that tour in Europe and do those things and do that promotion, to invest. But investment seems to have really, really dried up, and it's all the responsibility on the artist. But you know, the greats will always come through, that's for sure. Yeah. But for people, especially in the rock industry, when it's niche and there's not as many outlets, the 2 or 3 year thing where the labels and investors go, these are worth investing in. Let's get these out in Europe. Let's just do this. Let's have this plan and push these guys. And, you know, I'm sure that we can take off with these songs. They're sitting on the fence now until the 10-year period, when you've really got some momentum going and the job's more or less done. You've got the fan base, and you've got the all the promoters of the festivals putting you on the main stage, because they're all comfortable with what you do and how you do it, to have the confidence that you can go on the main stage and do your business and please their thousands of ticket payers to come to these festivals, which we got to that level. But if everybody's going to wait for 10 years, especially in rock bands, I mean, just to survive.
I mean, that's the crazy thing, isn't it? I mean, like you're saying there, about 10 years since the start of it, should we say. And yet at the time of you sort of like hitting the rock scene, it was almost like you had such a great backing with various different radio stations. You almost had like a meteoric rise. But at the same time, it takes, from what you're saying there, a long time for the rest of it to catch up. And if you're saying 10 years is a long time to be slogging it in to just reduce the risks of the industry when they put you off the stage, it seems a bit unfair, doesn't it?
I won't say unfair, but I'm just, I think it's more, depends obviously what genre you pick. You know, I picked rock and roll because I've always been a fan of rock and roll, and it's what makes me happy. And when you're driving a van for 10, 12 hours across Germany to do a 20 minute slot at a festival to try and make your name and all the rest of the, commitment that you need to show to it, it just proved to me that, you know, we were on the A-list of most of the rock radios, like you say, Planet Rocker mainly for us, which was amazing, and kind of like quite accepted, well accepted within the industry. It was a tough one because a few quite established publications, they didn't like where I'd come from. They didn't like I was a sportsman trying to come to the rock world, and it was. I knew it was always going to be a bit of a difficult bridge to cross on getting respected as a musician, but luckily I played piano and I played an instrument. It wasn't just me having to go at singing, it was, and also songwriting as well, so it took some time to get that respect there, but I felt like it did come. But we quickly realized that with rock and roll in the UK, there's a real glass ceiling to how many ears are able to listen to your art. I mean, Planet Rock, because of the cost on being on digital DAB1, was so costly for them. Came to DAB2, which I think knocked out a little bit of Scotland at the time, and Norfolk, I think.
Yeah, it did.
They lost it there for a while, and that really it went from over a million listeners to about 700,000-800,000 listeners, and even though if you're in, I mean, you know, you're in the journalist world, so your ears to the ground, and you'll hear about it anyway. But in the rock world, even when you're on all the A-list of the radios in rock world, and the publications are saying decent things about you, you're still after 10 years pulling 200-500 people, and it's you know, compared to the pop world where you've got 7-8 million listeners on the BBC channels, etc. So it's a long old slog, but you know, as the ACDC said, if you want to rock and roll, it's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll, I suppose.
That's true. Yeah, that's so true, isn't it? That's coined it all, I think, James, hasn't it?
I think, I mean, obviously, it was obviously a thing then.
It must have been.
And I think it has. It's always been a thing if you want to rock and roll. You know, it's, but you know, you've got to follow what you love doing, because when I've done all those things and lost all that money, investing that money and that commitment and all the things behind, which are difficult within the industry that we've just talked about, driving the van around, you've got to be backstage going, I can't wait to get out there and deliver this message and do what we do and bring a lot of enjoyment to people that are coming to see you do it. And that outweighs all of what I've just said. If you can just love what you do, it's amazing what that emotion outweighs.
Now, I'd love to play one of your tracks. Have you got a favourite that you would like?
Ooh.
That's hard, isn't it? I know, just like trying to choose one of your children, isn't it, really?
Well, luckily, I'm only two albums in. I'm not 12 or 13, like, I think Never Love Another Like You is one that's got a personal lyric to it. It's about my grandfather that I lost. I know you're not supposed to really tell people what it's about, to make their own mind up and make their own connection with it, but it was where I lost my grandfather. And it's called Never Love Another Like You.
Touch my chest for my heart. Is it still beating? My vision blurs in time to see. But it's so fleeting. Was meant to be. Why is it still hurting? The part you took is forever yours. Do you still feel it? The rope you tied is loosening, but I still need it.
Hi, my name is James Toseland, the lead singer of Toseland, and you're listening to Cat Tales.
So that adrenaline when you go on stage must be quite a hit for you, but does it compare to your motorcycle days? You know, when you're racing, it's a different kind of adrenaline, I'd have thought, but do you get that high?
It's more nerve-wracking going on stage for two reasons. One is at 200 miles an hour, you can't see anybody.
That's true.
Yeah. But like not so much seeing anyone on stage. You walk out, they're all looking at you, straight at you.
Yeah.
And then they're looking at you on the racetrack, but you're not looking at them, and you're not trying to deliver a message. It's much more simple sport. You know, you win, everybody's happy. You're second or third, everybody's pretty happy. You're 10th, everybody's not so happy. It's just simple. And you know, music is art. It's subjective, and it's not for everybody. Even if you think you've written the best song going, right? So it's so difficult to judge.
Yeah.
It can be really disheartening when people don't connect to the things that you connect with, and that's the customer of kind of getting involved in this, thinking that I'm going to supply the same amount of enjoyment to people than I was winning races. And it wasn't that simple, as I found out.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, I'd actually, you know, I'd thought the same thing. It was almost like you've had two different distinct careers, both of them successful. But, the first one with your motorcycle racing is all about very black and white, isn't it? Win, lose, that's it. Then where you are now is that creative grey area. And you're right with that sort of, somebody judges you, don't they, in terms of, well, I don't know whether that's any good, or it's very subjective. Yeah. That must be quite tough.
Yeah, it is, but you've got to, die by the sword that you're on. And it's you've got to believe in what you do, and you've got to be honest, completely frankly honest. And if you can look yourself in the mirror with the message that you're putting across, then it doesn't matter so much. It really doesn't matter. I think if you're trying to push something that's dishonest, then you're in trouble. Or if you're trying to push somebody else's message that you're trying to get across in a strong way. And I think that's what rock and roll does give. I knew that the songs needed to be mine. You know, I collaborated with a great guy called Toby Jepson with both albums so far. And this one, who's obviously well known from the Little Angels days, and I was doing his Wayward Sons band. And but when we started working together, we were very, very similar people. And I basically told him my life story and who I was and who I was about. And I wanted to write about this kind of subject. All my songs so far have been conversations between me and Toby Jepson, and finding song titles about our life experiences. And because of that, it's very raw and very believable to me, and very honest. And it's not really trying to convince anybody else. It's just my stories. So, I'm not looking for appreciation on what the content of the songs are. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. About authenticity, isn't it? And if it's telling your story is what it is, isn't it? You don't necessarily have to have somebody to agree with it, but to appreciate it's a different thing, isn't it?
Exactly. And we've been really, really lucky that what we have had back, it's been really, really positive, and we come to wish for more as a new band, a new rock band, with the difficulties of where I've come from, and trying to get that respect within a very, very difficult industry. I don't think we could have wished for any more, even though the industry is very, very difficult, but that's not for us, that's for everybody. It's just the way it is, and if you believe in it so much, you just got to keep on doing it, and just hope that your followers kind of keep following.
And keep going with you, absolutely. So looking back then, what would you pick out as in the last 10 years as some of your highlights that you've done? Because you've toured with some great names like Deep Purple and Blackstone Cherry, and you've done some great single We'll Stop at Nothing that was adopted by the Special Olympics and things like that. What would you suggest is your, one of your finest moments?
I think personally, the Special Olympics, because when they picked that song, and when I watched the VT that they put with the song alongside it, it was really, really a proud moment, because we did a video to that, but it was more of a promotion for a product that we did it for. But it was like a second video when we did the VT for the Special Olympics, and it really, really pleased me, because I was really proud of that song. But I didn't think the first video did it justice of the narrative of it. And when I saw the footage of those brave Paralympians doing what they do, and hearing "We'll stop at nothing" to it all, it kind of connected my old world with my new world, with just that doggy dog determination to succeed at all costs. And there isn't anybody with more determination than the Paralympians who have gone through what they've been through in life and then succeed at those unbelievable challenges that they go through is just incredible. So that was why that's probably stand out for me. Having the opportunity with Deep Purple was amazing, and the whole band and the whole crew that with Deep Purple, they welcomed us very, very nicely, because sometimes when you tour with huge bands and you support them, it's a little bit, right, okay, just warm these guys up, get on, get off, and we don't want to see you or hear from you. It's like having kids around you. You know, we don't want to hear you or see you. Just get on.
Yeah.
But I didn't realise, but what I tell you what broke the ice with Deep Purple, Ian Gillan used to sponsor a motorcycle racing team when he was younger. And he didn't know who I was until his guitarist, Steve, brought a poster from his best friend in America, he's American, and of me, and he wanted to sign him. And I didn't know that anybody knew in the whole Deep Purple crew who I was before. And he brought this poster and got it signed. And as I was doing that, Ian was just in the room, and just sparked up a whole conversation with Ian, and absolutely loved it. And and then from then on, we did about four shows, two or three in Italy and two in Germany. And it was just great, because, you know, we were welcomed into the catering after that. And, you know, if you want any food, and, you know, just things like that, which make a massive difference to a band touring Italy and Germany in a van.
Yeah, it would, wouldn't it? Oh, it would. And how lovely of you to actually, you know, you look up to these people, don't you, before you actually get into the industry, and you think, oh my goodness me, they're completely untouchable. But then actually being embraced by them, and motorcycling actually bridging that gap for you. That must have been great.
Yeah, it did. On every tour that we've done, like some Cherry, Status Quo, fantastic, because we were fortunate enough to get the Fantastic Four tour when they all got back together again.
Oh, lovely.
And, you know, that was special because all the guys were coming back together again. It was unbelievable for us because all the Status Quo fans got in there as the doors opened to stick as close to the front to see them all together again. So when we went on, it was packed.
Oh, yeah.
That was special for us, just to have that. Just little things like that, you know, can just make that little bit of difference, because obviously when you're supporting and you're going on at 7:30 and it's only quarter to fall and stuff like that, you're only able to, like the radio problem that we've got with the listeners, when you're doing the live shows, if you're supporting people and it can be full and going to more people, it can just you know, get a lot of people going home talking about it rather than just a few. So that tour was very, very important to us.
Oh, great.
Every tour I've done, at some point someone mentions something to someone, and I've noticed a lot of crew are all bike fans.
Yes. A lot of the rock industry, it goes hand in hand, actually, doesn't it? I can see how it could help.
Yeah. and it never came from me either.
Yes, that's better.
And then because it broke the ice with the conversation, all of a sudden, the little things that can just make your life a bit easier from that point, you know, then one or two of their crew would maybe carry something in for us, or and it's a little fun with the music industry, and I think it's got the pockets of the pockets of the rock, and if you're in the rock industry, it's a great family to be a part of. Everybody looks out for each other.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what it's about, isn't it, really? So what's next then, James? Are you working on an album at the moment, hoping for next year touring, or what are you doing?
I've had a bit of an issue since retiring from racing 9 years ago with my right wrist.
Oh, I saw.
I've got the fourth operation on it next Tuesday.
Oh.
And it was about 8 months ago. I had the third procedure on it, and they took four bones out of the wrist and replaced it with a special new disc, like a disc wrist replacement.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I've had complications with it again, and I've got to go back in for a modification. We need to take some more bone out. And this is next Tuesday. And I've not been able to play the piano for quite some time now, because I've literally got a cast on as we speak. And this is 8 months after the operation itself. So that's how much, I can't even brush my teeth with it. That's how bad it is, unfortunately. And So we've got quite a few songs up and running, and everything's there to kick the system back off. But I'm just hoping, and fingers crossed, that this procedure on Tuesday goes as we were hoping that the third one was going to go, and I'll be able to have a wrist that can bend slightly, because I've not been able to bend my wrist for 9 years at all. It's been more or less fused. And it made playing the piano very, very difficult. And now it's not just difficult, it's painful. And when it's difficult and painful, I haven't wanted to do it. And it's been a really tough period, because the pain and the uncomfortableness and the wrist, it's not just difficult for my new job now with playing and singing. It's a constant reminder of what took my career away as well.
Yeah.
So it's
It's been
a massive a massive journey. So the surgeon's confident that he'll make this modification and we'll have what we were hoping for. And if we do, then playing and everything else will be back up and running, and I'll be in the right frame of mind to kicking on doing this third album and getting the boys back together again, getting back in the room and going and. I've got some money left going out and tour.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Just in time for 2021 when it all opens again.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully, yeah. It might come on, to be honest, I mean, like, you're joking aside, I mean, to have these issues that I've had for the last year, I haven't missed as much as I could have done the industry itself. So, but that's not, I don't want that to be a positive, but in a sense, when it comes to career-wise, if everything can go well on next Tuesday, hopefully by the time we've got some music recorded, we can go out there and actually perform live.
Oh, I'm sure it will go well. So, well, good luck with that, and good luck with the third album. In the meantime, people can obviously buy your existing albums, so they can go online and get those and stream some of your music and hopefully help with the funding of the next tour.
Yeah.
James, it's been an absolute pleasure. Problem. And I do honestly, sincerely hope your hand gets better and your operation goes well next week.
Yeah, cheers, Kat. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Take care. Bye-bye. See you then. Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye. You've been listening to Cat Tales.
To listen again to this and other tales, go to cattales.co.uk.